it's time for Toker Talk Radio, the voice of the marijuana nation.
What are you people? On dope?
Where you can toke.
I inhale. Frequently.
Or you can talk.
I experimented with marijuana and didn't inhale.
Or you can toke and talk.
10 federal criminal penalties for possession of up to 1 ounce of marijuana.
While we talk about toke on Toker Talk Radio.
So by the way, when it comes to pot, you know, if you're 40 years old, you live in a log cabin in Oregon, you got 12 giant pot plants in your backyard, have a ball.
Live from beautiful Portland, Oregon at Rolla J Studios.
Cannabis.
Plus your calls live at 971-533-7111.
They're walking on their pants with their cap on backwards, listening to Enema Man and Snoopy Snoopy Poop Dog.
What's to keep somebody from getting all potted up on weed and then getting behind the wheel?
Gateway theory doesn't work. It's a reality.
Holland, is it real? Don't tease me.
We're locking up people that take a couple of puffs of marijuana, and the next thing you know, they got 10 years.
And now, here's your host, the guru of ganja graphics, the sultan of sativa statistics, and the worst nightmare of a reefer mad prohibitionist. A polite, perspicacious, productive pothead with a propensity for PowerPoint. Radical Russ Belville.
All right, welcome back, tokers and tokettes and non-toking lovers of liberty. It is Monday, April 18th, 2016. I'm Radical Russ. We're still here in New York City attending the Cannabis Science and Policy Summit held at the City University of New York. We've got all sorts of panels going on. I'm still quite busy getting involved with all of those, getting the recordings done for you. We'll be bringing you these recordings throughout the rest of this week. Plus, you can check on cannabisradio.com. We'll all post some of the full audio from some of these presentations and panels. You can do your own research on that. I'm going to clip out some of the best of the stuff that I've heard over this past week and bring it to you here on the Russ Belville Show and on Toker Talk Radio. So you'll be able to get your full dose of cannabis science, policy, history, culture, health, everything you'd ever want to know about the cannabis plant. We're going to start off this one with some activism. I was able to meet with the activists from DCMJ on Pennsylvania Avenue in front of the White House, where they were ready to give away cannabis seeds, seedlings, and cannabis itself in accordance with Washington, D.C.'s legalized grow and give system. The Secret Service didn't seem to like that idea and moved us out to H Street, but we still had the event, and it was really exciting to see all the citizens in Washington, D.C., the adults who were able to line up and get some free cannabis. We take you now back to Washington, D.C. this last weekend.
We legalized cannabis, and right here, this street is D.C. property, so we are here exercising our freedom. The police conveniently closed off that area, but we are here. Can I get a stamp to show they're 21? Some folks have brought seeds to share, buds to share, but we're making sure that everyone is an adult because it's only legal if you're an adult over 21 years of age. In 2014, 115,000 District of Columbia residents voted to legalize the home possession and growth of cannabis at their home. You can carry up to 2 ounces of marijuana on you in the District of Columbia on non-federal land. You can give up to 1 ounce of seeds, buds, or cuttings to other adults. And today we are sharing seeds and buds with other adults. So we're going to create a line if we can. Make sure we're not trying to mob each other. Make sure you introduce yourself to your neighbor. We are all friends here. This is a 2016 seed share outside the White House. We were here 2 weeks ago with a 51-foot inflatable joint. It was pretty epic. This is also going to be an open mic. This is a White House seed share and cannabis summit. We want to hear stories about you. We want to hear stories about the seeds you're sharing, the buds that you've got to share to other adults. And if you are a person that has cannabis to share, you should come over here.
Radical Russ here on the South Lawn of the White House, where DCMJ is participating in a White House seed share and cannabis summit. You can find out more information at info@dcmj.org. They are exhibiting their grow and give rights here in D.C., where they can share cannabis with others.
It's unclear how many people have brought cannabis to share. But if you do, have some. Check the person's hand to see if they've proven that they're an adult so you don't get in trouble. If you are leaving, leave through Pennsylvania Avenue. Because technically Pennsylvania Avenue is District of Columbia property. The park behind us is federal land. If you walk through the park carrying cannabis on you, you could get arrested for possession on federal property. One of the reasons why we're here today is to try to tell Obama that he should use his power as the President of the United States to completely take cannabis off the Controlled Substances Act. Take it off. It's been down there for over 40 years now, and it's done absolutely nothing but put millions of people in jail, ruin lives. As a Schedule I substance, it's on par with LSD and heroin. But methamphetamine, that's a Schedule II. Obama's saying methamphetamine is safer than marijuana. Isn't that messed up, folks?
Well, okay, we're not that giving away wrong. Seats yet. We're getting there.
You need to literally stop.
And we're here to remind the president that he has power to leave a legacy to the American people that he freed not just 200, but thousands, hundreds of thousands of people that are in jail right now for the possession of a plant.
Well, at least nobody's in line.
Or we need a single file line.
Excuse me, Radical Russ from Cannabis Radio. What you got going here for the signatures?
This is to raise the minimum wage in D.C. to $15 an hour.
Oh, I'm so glad you're doing that. How's your signature gathering going today?
It's great today. We've got a captive audience.
No doubt about that. Well, good luck with you.
Great, thank you.
I'm Radical Russ from Cannabis Radio. Anyone want to talk? We want to say how cool this is. Everybody's shy. It's radio and everybody's shy. Nobody can see you. Nobody can find you.
We definitely are having a ball out here.
I was going to say, if I didn't have such like an important thing to like have to hide this about, like I would say something.
I get you. Well, it's a beautiful thing. I'm out from Portland, Oregon, so getting to see people on the East Coast be able to have free weeds, pretty nice. Keep it up, you guys. Good work.
Who can say that I can prove I'm safe? Because where I normally go for my safety, I've moved away, but choose to stay now. I let people assume that I'm great, but lately they can seem to see through the gates and the land on the other side where I reside is losing its shit. Walls are breaking, the fence is rusty. Property is up for the taking, but the windows are dusty. They can't see inside of the wall. There's no reason to, because these floors that I walk on have no foundation. Yet I talk on, I see chalk on the board for life, lessons to be learned. But I'm too focused on the fern that I burned to be worried about my father scorn, his only born, his most adored. Giving me advice that I just ignore, see, he may think that it's wise, but it's based on what I deem as folklore. I've got heart sores and closed pores, not opening up, man, that's too much of a chore. Feel I need cleansing, but can't find the right soap in the store. Can't find hopes so people contemplate of the end by rope, not me though, but I can see where they're coming from. In a sticky situation, like they spend all day walking on chewing gum, I mean me, I feel I've been bruising some, I can't even find this here music fun. I steer clear of stupid fub, and instead I'm in the garden, it's fruitless sun, damn. I'm a vegetable. My brain is dead and my heart is still numb. I look in the sky like, who's the son? Can I talk to his father? Cause yo, I'm not the one. No, you say that's blasphemy, nah. I just got questions, won't run. See, walk by faith and not by sight. Mess around and walk into her and bail another man one night. So you may be hurt, but you'll be alright. Pain is temporary, at least by the time you take this flight, right? High but a strife that you deal with in your life. But that glimmer of hope flickers and then fades. March thought to the desire I replace.
Right, so we can't go into the we go that way?
The thing is, we have to clear the avenue, so if you guys want to go that way, you're going to have to go to
Pennsylvania Avenue. Can we go up to 8th Street over there?
To 17th Street or 8th Street, yes.
Okay.
All right, is that all right?
Thank you.
Everybody. All right, guys. Yeah, we appreciate your cooperation.
If you feel like it's something that benefits you in your life, thank you so much for being here and sharing what your experience is.
Secret Service is beginning to motion for us to move.
At Cannabis Summit, we've just been asked by the Secret Service to relocate because they are closing down Pennsylvania Avenue conveniently to kick us off. So we're going to relocate to the top of 16th Street to H, so when we take photos, we'll still have the White House in the background. So if you do... would like to follow us, please do. We're going to be walking straight out of the park that way and going up to the top of the sidewalk over there.
All right, folks, we're going to take ourselves another break here, pay a few more of the bills. But when we come back, we've got more of the highlights from my East Coast swing. I was in Washington, D.C., actually Arlington, Virginia, to be accurate, for the SSDP National Conference. And we've got Steve from Flexure Rights will be joining us right after the break to tell us all about a new application that can help us keep tabs on the cops. Be right back right after this.
This is the Russ Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
Northwest Alternative Health, Eugene's premier medical marijuana clinic, is proud to sponsor the Oregon Marijuana Business Conference. Are you prepared for the changes in the recreational and medical marijuana markets? The OMB presents the state's top industry experts, along with over 40 exhibitors, and features a keynote by Dr. Carl Hart. Also, tickets include a celebrity interview and private after party with the one and only Tommy Chong. Join us Sunday, April 24th at the downtown Eugene Hilton and be a part of Oregon's fastest growing industry. Check out OregonMBC.com for more details.
New beginner guitars and banjos are often constructed much better than ones built before your time. Why struggle? Get a new instrument or fix the old one. The trusted professionals at the Fingerboard Extension will evaluate your instrument for free. Repairs are priced for people who work for a living. Stop by the Fingerboard Extension downtown Corvallis at 120 Northwest 2nd Street today or check out its inventory on the web at fingerboardextension.com.
Warning, hits taken on this show are larger than they appear. Do not try this at home. These people are professionals. Or at least they pay me to say that. This is Dan Michaels from danmichaelsaudio.com, and you're listening to Radical Russ on CannabisRadio.com.
Welcome back, everybody. Radical Russ here at the Students for Sensible Drug Policy Conference in Arlington, Virginia. And we're joined by Steve, who's got a very interesting application to tell us about. Steve, tell folks about the app and more, you know, what it's all about.
Sure thing. I've been a Know Your Rights educator for about 15 years. We've made a couple of educational videos. The most recent one was 10 Rules for Dealing with Police. And, we've helped protect a lot of people during their rights. People who say, well, I asked the officer, am I free to go? I didn't consent to searches, and I was able to, exit that police encounter safely. But still, a lot of people do assert their rights well after viewing our materials and still say, Steve, I still had a negative encounter. The officers were discourteous. They were abusive. Maybe even there was excessive force. What should I do now? And so the shorthand is, well, you should file a police complaint. But there's a lot of caveats that go into that. There are certain scenarios where you might not want to directly file a police complaint. So long story short, what we've created is a web app which takes you through that process. It's called Open Police Complaints. It's kind of like TurboTax, but for your police complaints. But instead of doing your tax returns, essentially we're making it easier for you to create a perfect professional quality police complaint that you can submit directly to the department, the particular department where the incident happened. But then a lot of people say, well, they're going to ignore that anyway, and they might. So the other avenue we have is that we're able to publicly publish the complaint with the officer's name attached, and everything is public. So this is part of an open source data campaign as well. So even if the departments ignore it, you will be able to submit it publicly online as well. So we can create an extra layer of transparency for your complaint.
Have you heard any from police unions that might object to an officer being accused of some sort of wrongdoing and that being made publicly available before it's been adjudicated?
Well, the app is still currently in development. In fact, we're doing user testing right now, also known as beta testing. And so when it does get released, I do anticipate that we will have some departments that will object to the fact that we will be, in some cases, publicizing the officer's name. For example, if the user decides to sort of go the fully brave route, which is having their name public, we will, by reciprocity, also allow the officer's name to be public as well. And so if departments are upset about the fact that that's public, what we will do is we will urge them to go ahead and investigate that complaint as soon as possible. That is the best way to adjudicate any possible malicious allegations. Of course, we're not going to be able to tell. We can't get into the complainant's minds. We're not going to encourage people to file malicious complaints. But when it comes to that level, that's where we urge the departments to go ahead and file to investigate those complaints. And if they arrive at a different conclusion, they can publish that alongside the complaint itself. And we urge them to arrive at what's called a final disposition letter. Oftentimes, it's usually just mailed to the complainant themselves. And we'll also urge and allow complainants to post those letters as well. So we're trying to create more data. We're trying to collect it. We're trying to make it more publicly accessible so that there's better transparency. So I think this will allow for better outcomes. It'll help identify officers that might have behavioral problems to make it easier for those police chiefs to feel a little bit more pressure to take some action, help other third-party lawyers, community activists to access this data to try to identify trends of how policing is happening in their communities.
This application is something to be used post-encounter. Does it do? It doesn't do any video recording or audio recording?
The app essentially it pairs well with any sort of video recording you have. So if you do use an app that does record video, even just your own phone's native app, when you do create your complaint, you can attach that link if you've uploaded it to YouTube or Vimeo, and you can attach that link to the evidence section of your complaint if, in fact, you have collected video. But the app itself is primarily focused on creating a perfect police complaint.
And the complaint will be forwardable online through the app to any city, county, state, department?
You'll be able to, well, for one, you'll be able to share it, you know, through your own social media networks, but it can be submitted directly to your department. Now, there will be some exceptions because some departments simply will not allow a complaint to be submitted via email, which will be our primary mechanism. They'll say, oh, it needs to be submitted on our actual form. You need to come into the station. Some departments have some bad, very closed policies. And so what we can do, if that is the case, if your department insists you must file it on their form, you must come into the station, we'll say, well, you have an option to go ahead and copy the report, submit it, you know, to the station or mail it in. But meanwhile, we're also keeping a record of what departments have bad policies for collecting complaints so that we can score them and evaluate them over time, because we think the best practice is to be open, is to allow complaints to be submitted through third parties. And so if the department doesn't accept it through these things, we'll be able to essentially keep score of that. Meanwhile, the complaint will be submitted in full through our website so that other third-party activists, accountability people, lawyers, academics will be able to access it. So we no longer fully have to rely on just the police departments themselves to police themselves. We're giving them a little bit of help.
Oh, that's fantastic, Steve. And you say it's in beta development right now, but right. When people want to get their hands on this, where will they go?
Oh, openpolicecomplaints.org. Okay. And that's connected through it'll be connected through flexyourrights.org, which is our long-term site. The Open Police Complaints is a project of flexyourrights.org.
Yeah, Flex Your Rights was one of the first organizations that I happened upon when I started my activism 10 years ago, and I've always found your videos and materials to be very helpful for people to demystify the police encounter. I mean, I read a tweet the other day that said, I'm sure glad we learned about parallelograms in high school. It comes in real handy here during parallelogram season, alluding to tax season, right? Right. They don't teach us these things, and you guys have been doing a great job in doing that. Have you broadened that outreach to, I know the Black Lives Matter movement is very popular, tailored that outreach to different groups?
Well, absolutely. You know, the Black Lives Matter has been, I think, a very important movement for bringing attention to police accountability issues. And so all of our materials are available and are embraced by all the different communities that are out there, whatever, you know, with all the different social movements that are concerned about police oversight, accountability, equity under the law and the Constitution. Our materials have been embraced.
All right. Check it out. Openpolicecomplaints.org.
That's right. Complaints. It could be. Okay. There will be multiple complaints, I hope.
And flexyourrights.org if you can't remember that.
Thanks, Russ.
All right. Thank you so much, Steve.
Appreciate it.
Hey, you in my class?
I am today.
Great websites today need expert web design and development, and need to be e-commerce ready and mobile friendly. But building a marketable and profitable website can be an uphill climb. Ready to make your new website or replace your existing website? Think Orange as the new way to get in the black. Orange Hill Development works with Fortune 500 companies and offer the same top quality development service at a fraction of what other providers charge. Brands like Absolute, Carlsberg, and Nestlé trust Orange Hill Development. Find out why you should trust your website with Orange Hill. Contact Orange Hill for a consultation today at orangehilldevelopment.com.
Coming soon to a city near you, Cannabis Finance Bootcamp. Get all your cannabis accounting, legal, and compliance questions answered by their knowledgeable panel of industry experts who want to help your cannabis business boom. Whether you're a grower, dispensary operator, or a newcomer to the field, your cannabis business needs Cannabis Finance Bootcamp. For information on upcoming events, visit CannabisFinanceBootCamp.com.
Remember, friends, there's more to life than marijuana. I just can't remember what it is. Why'd I come in here? This is the Rush Belville Show on CannabisRadio.com.
Welcome back, Tokers and Tokettes. We now bring you forward to the Cannabis Science and Policy Summit that's taking place Sunday and today here at the Graduate Center at the City University of New York, sponsored by Botec and NYU. And we bring you to the second half of a panel that was entitled Designing Reforms Short of Legalization, that featured Mike Trace, the former UK Deputy Drug Czar, Bo Kilmer, the co-director of RAND's Drug Policy Research Center, Norm Wetterau, the physician and addiction specialist, Sue Roosh, the president and CEO of National Families in Action, and your next speaker, Kevin Sabet, the CEO of Project SAM.
Okay, perfectly clear speech again. We're doing well. No pressure, Kevin. Now Kevin Sabet, our third speaker. Kevin, tell us what you think.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks, Mike, and thanks for everyone for coming to this discussion. I think it's an incredibly important discussion and one that, really does get short shrift. It's not as sexy, it's not as glamorous as talking about sort of what legalization or legal regulation is like. And I think it's also just a lot more confusing. I think it's actually a lot more difficult for the reasons that, both Bo and Dr. Wetterau sort of discussed today. I remember, actually, Rob McCoon was one of my professors, and, Bo was my TA over more than 10 years ago at Berkeley, and we won't talk about where Rob has since gone to since Berkeley. That was devastating to hear. You know, I remember one of the first classes that we had on drug policy, he asked everybody to raise their hand if they thought California had decriminalized marijuana. Two people raised their hand. I was one of them, I think I'll proudly say. And I think it was about maybe one or two others out of a class of maybe 100. No one knew that California had decriminalized marijuana for the last, from at that time, 20 plus years. I remember another, and sort of, I'm going to get into some stats and some slides, but I think these are important anecdotes. I remember another, my second day on the job in the Obama administration, we were getting together to talk about what would President Obama's drug strategy look like. And we had received a lot of input from different people. And one thing we heard is, you know, we saw is you should legalize drugs just like Portugal did. And I was like, well, wait a minute. And then they had a, they had like 10 newspaper articles, you know, with the headline basically being Portugal legalizes drugs, use goes down, or Portugal legalizes drugs and harms have gone down. And it was, you know, obviously for those of us who followed Portugal, we knew that they didn't, you know, legalize in the sense of Colorado and Washington, and in reality, the supply is not legal at all, that it was simply sort of an administrative kind of process, which people like Alex and others have written a lot about. But that just showed the tremendous confusion about what was, you know, about what people thought policies were. And then there was, you know, another time where Massachusetts was considering to decriminalize marijuana in 2008. And when, you know, somebody looked at, well, what is this proposed versus other decriminalized states? And it was completely different. So I just think this goes to the difficulty in these concepts. And people ask me, actually, and they say when we're talking about, you know, it's very clear where my views are on legalization. I think that completely agree with John this morning that we are on our way in the United States to creating a tobacco or alcohol-like model that, unfortunately, a lot of the good research that many of us do, and not many, but others do here, you know, gets like, you know, thank you for your work, we're going to shelf it while we listen to the industry. And that's very unfortunate. But, you know, I get a lot of people saying, well, why don't you just come out and say decriminalization, that you're in favor of decriminalization, Kevin? Because you've said, Kevin, that you don't want to see people go to prison. You don't want to see people low-level amounts get arrest records. Because one thing we haven't talked about yet is the devastating effect that an arrest record in this day and age of the internet can have. And you may not have served. You know, we know that there's less than 0.5% of people in state prisons for marijuana possession alone. But we also know that 700,000, not people, but instances of arrest, probably a lot of overlap. We don't know how much overlap. Probably not enough to say that it's minuscule. I mean, it's like hundreds of thousands of probably different people have arrests every year in this country, usually resulting from a, you know, traffic stop or some other issue that was going on that marijuana was then found in the pocket or smelled or whatever, that would lead to an arrest that could be on that person's record. And so, you know, Kevin, talk about decriminalization. The difficulty, though, and I don't think we've come up with a term, is that term is just terribly overbroad and unclear. Because my response is, okay, well, do you mean, you know, youth or adults? Public or private use? Supply or demand side? Plants or no plants? 1 ounce, 2 ounces, half an ounce, three joints, 60? How do we define what that means? And so I think it's just been it's a task for the academic community to think about, you know, what are some more specific and better terms? How can we talk about these issues more sort of, yeah, more specifically and say, well, this is what I mean when I say that. And I don't think that happens a lot. So there's just so much confusion about what decriminalization means. If you looked at the headlines after Colorado legalized the supply of marijuana in November of 2012, one of our research assistants did this at UF. Over half of the headlines uses the word, and articles use the word, decriminalization. Colorado had decriminalized marijuana since 2001. Denver had legalized possession in the mid-2000s. That wasn't the new news of November 2012. The new news was that the supply is legal, we're going to have stores, and we're going to have candy and advertising and all that. That was the news. But decriminalize was the word used in over half of the news stories. The coverage in Colorado, you can't use the excuse that these were papers outside the state. Many of them were in the state. So I do think it's terribly confusing. So I will go to the slides. I wanted to show this in case John didn't show it, but he did, which is very good. Obviously, just very quickly, and I'm going to talk about this in the next session at 2, but you know, what do we get with current legalization? I think we get rampant commercialization. Colorado is now the number one state for youth use in the country. The advertising and commercialization, and we think a thriving underground market that sells to people who either aren't 21, don't want to buy, you know, want to buy their marijuana outside of hours, and more importantly, don't want to pay the hefty tax. I walked into a Colorado shop after they legalized, and there was a dividing line between the store. And they asked me, Kevin, are you medical? Let's say my first name. They didn't know my name. Are you medical? Are you recreational? They asked me. And I said, well, I don't know. What's the difference? What should I be? You know? And it was like, well, here's the thing. How much time do you have? Now, this was a strange question. How much time do I have? And they said, well, if you have about half an hour, we can get the physician here to do the review. $200 cash, and it's kind of like Costco. You get a membership card, and then you get discounts, like Costco. And by the way, they also had free samples. And so I said, well, all right, why would I do that? You've just legalized marijuana. People were dancing in the streets, you know, on the news. Remember the news coverage from New Year's around it? Because New Year's is a slow news cycle in the U.S. So you start. So there was so much out there. It was a huge news that on January 1st, 2014, you could go to a store in Colorado and buy recreational marijuana. I said, a week ago you were dancing in the streets about recreational. Why are you trying to steer me to the medical market? I get you get the $200, but is that the reason? And they said, well, because Kevin, the tax is not, you don't have the taxes you do on medical as you do in recreational. So if you have some time and you have and then it was like, do you have a headache? Do you have a backache? What do you have? If you have something wrong with you, you get your card and you get your less tax. It was just very eye-opening to me, and it showed where things were going. I think the other issue we don't talk about as much, but it's connected to commercialization, is the promotion of special interests. Last week in Colorado, a proposal for THC caps similar to the Netherlands. I mean, it's amazing. Rob hit the nail on the head when he said, we used to consider the Netherlands. That was like, oh my God, we never want to, you know, for those who were against legalization, like the Netherlands, we would never want to be like the Netherlands. Now we're like, can we please be like the Netherlands? You know, lower advertising, caps on 15% THC on a lot of products. It's just incredible how that has switched. But this just was... defeated in the legislature. There was a proposal for a limit on number and location of stores. There are, a Denver Post investigation found many more stores in poorer minority communities in Colorado than in the rest. Surprise, surprise, when you look at alcohol, very similar. So there was some legislation to try and limit that, failed. And then there was some other legislation in Washington, but also in Colorado, about where this money is going. What can it actually go to? Okay, we know we have the tax revenue. What can we do with it? And unfortunately, this was like a couple months ago in Washington State, that the proposal failed to divert it to prevention and treatment, even though that was the promise, diverted to the general fund instead, and I don't know, paying for salary increases and things like that. But that has been, I mean, maybe it's a uniquely American problem, very possible, a huge issue with the current thing. Now, I do want to flatter Bo by using his slide here on, this was a very helpful slide. This was the RAND Vermont continuum, 12 alternatives to the status quo. But as a good student, I'm going to challenge the teacher a little bit and say that while this is very helpful, in my mind, these were really just versions of legalization. In fact, I think but would agree that's what their versions of legal supply, which is what they were asked to do. But if we're looking at it outside the Vermont model, really the only U.S. model outside D.C. is the standard commercial model. This is where we've ended up. I think it might be helpful, and I just sort of took some time, not much time, so it's going to be very, very sort of, a draft and really kind of cut and dry. I tried to look at what are alternatives to the status quo that do not involve legalization. So rather than the alternatives for that do not involve standard commercial model, what are the alternatives? And I threw out some things from some different places. Obviously, this is the administrative process, which we have nothing like that in the U.S. in terms of an administrative process for what would have been a criminal type of sanction. It doesn't exist in our system. Doesn't mean we can't create it, but it doesn't exist right now. But what do we have? We have things like, in many places. In fact, this is really, if you look at the de facto U.S. policy, I would argue that we're really in most places, I would say, except for some counties in the Deep South, fines and misdemeanor offense for use. Now, if you look at California, you don't go anywhere near misdemeanor. And for low-level use, it's what they still call it a C summons, or it's a ticket, like a warning kind of thing. That doesn't even reach misdemeanor. So what are the different things? Obviously, Portugal, maybe what ASAM called for, assessment for use and referral to treatment. You could argue this is sort of the Dutch model, not enforcement. It's incredible that we're sort of citing the Dutch model towards prohibition versus the sort of what we have in the U.S. now, but in many ways we are. Grow your own, perhaps in small amounts. You could argue that's a sort of model of Washington, D.C., but there's considerable controversy in D.C. now about should we have cannabis clubs, should we have, sort of public spaces for that or not. That's an evolving policy. Do we just simply say, kind of what we said earlier, we're going to sort of ignore it, sort of like maybe the default Pakistan policy that, I'm not going to say that you said that, but, sort of this default policy of we're just kind of going to imagine that it's not here and tolerate private use. And then we go into the non-commercial supply. And there's probably tons more in there that you could talk about. But I don't think this gets talked about a lot. And I think that, we should try and think about what that would look like. The RAND report, I'm glad that Bo brought it up about sort of how much did Vermont spend on prohibiting marijuana. And in the year after decriminalization, as Bo mentioned, the criminal cases decreased 80%. So we know that there can be savings and costs about $1 per year is what I think the report said, right? That was very helpful work from RAND to look at what's actually been done and what are the things what are the outcomes of that. I'm not going to go into these models, but my point is that I did a very cursory look in the U.S. to look at what models there are. There are scores of different non-criminal models in different counties and states all over. The state of New Jersey has a conditional discharge program. In other words, you get assessed to either get education or treatment. 90% of people get education. They're not referred to treatment. And then it comes off of their record. Like in Leon County, Florida, it's first time and second time is civil citations. In Maryland, there's a diversion program. In Montgomery County, which is the largest county in Maryland, Maryland State has a decriminalization law now that requires a kind of education. The point is that these things are being implemented. They're not as sexy as Colorado or Washington or, Uruguay or other places that we discuss. But I think that they're worth looking at. And I don't think there's been a ton of evaluation. But I, with the caveats that not all decriminalization laws are alike. In the U.S., there's wide variation. In Europe, there's very wide variation. When you think about countries like the Czech Republic and Italy and Spain being different from maybe some other countries. So I think we have to realize that there is that diversity and sort of be on the same wavelength when it comes to the terms and make sure that we define the terms well before we talk about it. Otherwise, it sort of leads to a lot of confusion, but realize that there are many, many options and choices. I think, though, it's still a difficult question because, again, there are different circumstances. I would say almost you could argue that almost every kind of marijuana possession sort of interaction would be a different circumstance. Again, are they minors? Were they not? Were they using at the time? Were they not? Was it in public? Was it not? Were they driving? Were they not? How much was it? These are incredibly difficult questions that, when you're in the legislature trying to have a blanket law for everything. I think one of the reasons we haven't seen a lot of this implementation is it's just a lot harder to do. But hopefully we can begin thinking about it. Thank you.
Thanks, Kevin, and thanks to all of our speakers bringing us in just about on time. So we have 20, 25 minutes for discussion and debate. usual format, put your hand up, I'll call on you to speak. Wait for the microphone to get to you because this is being recorded. And I think I'm going to have to ask the organizers, is this going out in Pakistan? Because I'll have to retract that earlier comment. So I'll check out the confidentiality aspects. So feel free to put your questions and opinions openly to our speakers, and I'll moderate the process of the question. So hands up, first up, please. Lady there, and then the lady there.
Thanks. I really enjoyed this. So, Kevin, I certainly agree with you that there are a whole lot of different models that can be used, but one of the driving forces here is money. And how do you deal with that issue, that a lot of the states, and particularly as we heard earlier, that if one state starts to get all of the commercial, all of the financial benefits from it, and then it spills over?
I mean, obviously, that's a huge part of it, is money for states, money for industry, I actually just wrote an article about this for Mark's site on about.com. Who gets rich under decriminalization? I mean, maybe if you get the $100 fine or something and you can afford it. I think there are some problems with the fine structures. And sometimes it's more expensive to collect the fine than it is to get, when you have the money. So, I don't have an answer other than I think there does need to be, and this is probably, Bo can maybe speak to this, and it's going to be an incredibly difficult task, but you're going to have to make the case that the increased use that we already have and that people like Professor Calkins are talking about would dwarf any money that you would get. Right now, every dollar in alcohol and tobacco tax revenue that we get costs us $10 in the United States in social costs. It's about the same, 10 to 1 alcohol and tobacco. So I think you have to sort of try and make that case. But listen, if you're a legislator who gets voted in every 2 years and you have some pet projects that you want to do, who cares what's going to happen in 10 years with the social costs? Right now, your local county needs a new whatever. And if you can pay for it with the money this year that you get, you're going to be the hero versus saying, in 10 years, if we have this estimated increase in use that other people have called about, we're going to lose money. That's a different, more difficult political case.
It's not even just the time right. lag. It's sure. also that it's different sectors that are going to be paying for
Absolutely. Yeah. Right, exactly. Absolutely.
Thank you. Lady here.
Kevin, this question is again for you. You showed a slide that said Colorado is now the number one youth state users, and that there's rampant advertising and commercialization, and there's that thriving underground market of white, gray, and black. But aren't those figures really the case even before the legislation? Didn't we have a high use rate in Colorado prior to that? Didn't we have, advertising, I think. It might be underground advertising, but it gets to the users who are interested in that advertising, right? So there's a tremendous amount on social media, websites, and I think there's a thriving underground market no matter what. Yeah.
So let's be clear. Colorado, my understanding, is the first time that they are number one in the country, 12 to 17 past month use, which is the marker that we use. That's according to SAMHSA's state estimates that they released in December. They've always been high. I mean, they've always been in the top, not always, but they've been in the top 10 for a while. They're now number one. So that was what I was saying on the slide. Of course, they're under prohibition. The whole point is that there's a thriving underground market. Absolutely. My point was saying is that now we have the underground market, we have the legal market, which wasn't the case before legalization. That's the whole point of it by definition. And then we also now, as a result of the legal market, have the gray market. So we have I'm the older brother that's going to buy the candies legally and then sell them or bring them across to Nebraska or whatever. So that's what I was saying. And of course, I mean, yeah, I guess you sort of have advertising, the sort of your friend who, because most people get, of course, their cannabis not from a shady, dealer on the corner in the underground market. It's from an older sibling or a friend or whatever, someone usually that they know. Of course, there's sort of, if you call this advertising, me telling you that this joint is really good and you should try it, yes, but there isn't, Walmart of Weed Mart, advertising on, the freeway or Free Dab. And I didn't bring the pictures because this wasn't really later today is the discussion on legalization. But no, before legalization, you didn't have Free Dab advertising on the freeway. You didn't have the candies and the cookies and all the things and the sodas being marketed. You didn't have the Sesame Street characters that they're using. You didn't have the degradation of women that they're having in multiple different coupons focused on 18-year-old men to buy, on the medical side. So no, I would argue you absolutely didn't have that before legalization other than the medical market. And now you have that. And that's the...
I see it in Craigslist a lot, even in the places where it's not legal, right? And in that back page. Right, yeah. Sure.
Okay, a lot of hands going up now, but it's first come, first serve. So gentleman there, and then the gentleman here.
This question is to no one in particular, but touching on the medical cannabis regimes that we see in so many different states. How does that help or complicate the decriminalization efforts that y'all are discussing?
That's a great question. I mean, as most of you know, I mean, I think now there are, what is it, 20, Pennsylvania hasn't passed yet, but 23 states plus the District of Columbia make allowances for the flower, and then they're, you know, as John showed earlier, I think they're now up to 17 states that allow, that they're allowing the CBD oils. Whether or not you can actually get the CBD oils there is a whole nother story, but there's such a wide variation in terms of the different policies, you know, especially outside of the United States. California gets all the attention. It's so easy to get a card. The dispensaries are all over the place. It's very different in New York. It's, you know, very different in Vermont. And so I think the extent to which decriminalization would make a difference in terms of the criminal justice kind of expenditures and burdens is going to depend on the states. Like you know, California, I mean, everyone used to always be defined as a decriminalization state. You know, everyone thought they did it in the early 70s, but still could possibly be a criminal offense. So it really wasn't until January of 2011 that it really became decriminalized. And there, I mean, you did see kind of a reduction in arrests. But in terms of the total criminal justice burden, I mean, there are a lot of people that already have heavy users that already have protections because they already had a card. So you can imagine in a place like New York, well, New York is already decriminalized, but a place that had a much smaller and more restricted medical market, I think decriminalization could make much, you know, could make a bigger difference there. And that's what happened in Vermont. Vermont already had kind of a small, small medical system in place. But then, yeah, from the year before, year after, went from 1,600 criminal offenses to 300. And so,
The medical what happened in New York State is the medical society and organizations, and I was part of this thing, rather than opposing medical marijuana, we said medical marijuana needed to be approved by the FDA. It needs to be controlled, you see. And we sort of won over the governor. And so it is, it's a very different picture. And the physicians and you're told of the side effects and the advertising is very severely limited. And a lot of the people say, well, this is the worst medical marijuana bill in the country. And I sort of thought, wonderful, because I was a little bit compromising by even saying, well, maybe that's okay, face him. But so I think that, and so we have a different picture. Now, that may be overridden. People are very angry, certain people, when they want to change the law and go back. But so it's very controlled, and it's, you have to have scientific evidence for advertisement. There's a lot of stuff. It's a much more medical. It's not FDA approved. So the governor originally wanted to do research projects, first introduce research, but then the federal government gave, we won't go into that.
Just to add to that, I think the question again is about interaction between legalization and decriminalization. I have these here. It comes back to this question of objectives. You know, what objectives do you want to achieve with your reform, and can you achieve the objectives, or are you likely to achieve those objectives through different measures of different types of reform? So the question comes back to: is there a chance of achieving certain objectives through more moderate reforms, or can you only achieve those objectives by making bigger changes? That's the policy thought process. I have four on the list now, gentlemen here, and please wait for the microphone to come.
So the DEA is apparently considering rescheduling marijuana. This is a question for all the panelists. If the DEA says, all right, it's a Schedule 2, 3, or 4 drug, and we're going to enforce the law, what does that do to state recreational and state medical marijuana programs?
Do you mind if I start? So I think there's a huge amount of confusion about what rescheduling is. It is really a sort of arcane congressional term, legalistic, that has turned into a rallying cry for activists and some who think that they're speaking on behalf of researchers. Cocaine is a Schedule II drug. You can't buy, use, or do anything with cocaine outside this extremely narrow research protocol, which it's very, very, very narrow. Cocaine, obviously, penalties. This is the best analogy I can think of. Cocaine penalties are much harsher than marijuana penalties on the federal or state level. But cocaine is Schedule II and marijuana is Schedule I. People think, well, how is that the case? Well, it's because scheduling has nothing to do with penalties. And in terms of availability, actually very little to do with that. We have parts of the opiate plant that are Schedule II. you can't get them at a pharmacy because there's no of these parts that I'm talking about, because you don't have a specific medication that has also been approved by the FDA. So I just want to say at the outset, it's amazing to sort of observe this thing. The other thing is I don't have special knowledge on this, but I would bet the house that DEA is not rescheduling marijuana this year or anytime soon, because the issue is DEA has to consider rescheduling when somebody says, DEA, I want you to reconsider it. That can happen multiple times a year. There was one news story written in the Huffington Post a few weeks ago, and I'm glad there's going to be a journalist panel later, saying a true headline, DEA is considering rescheduling. Yeah, they've considered rescheduling every year for the last 20. It's nothing new. Unless we knew of new studies that said that there was a specific product that whole plant, whole flower marijuana in 2015, since the last time they made a determination, which was 2011, unless there's all those things have emerged, there's absolutely no reason to think that they're actually going to say, let's reschedule. Now, if they did, and that was your question, I'm certain they will not. They will not reschedule marijuana. If they did, it was Schedule 2 or whatnot, you still couldn't prescribe it and you still couldn't use it. It would make no difference, because there's no specific medication that is approved by the FDA. Now, descheduled, which is now what Representative Blumenauer and the Drug Policy Alliance and Marijuana Policy Project, that's much more honest, I think, on their side, because descheduled certainly would make it like alcohol and tobacco. Rescheduling to 2 or 3 is not where the ball is at all. Yeah, go ahead. From Nida here. Yeah.
If it were rescheduled, it would help.
Just to say that the only thing that would be helped if it were rescheduled to Schedule 2 would be research, because there are some additional hurdles and burdens that go along with Schedule 1 for doing research, but everything else.
Of course, it wouldn't make it easy to do research. No. I mean, it's still very difficult. Yeah. Schedule 2. So I have actually argued that there are many other. Now that I'm not in government, I can do this. Many other things other than rescheduling, if you care about research, that you should focus on if you really want to do research on marijuana. That focusing on let's reschedule to 2 is missing the debate, because there are so many things within 2 that are actually problematic even.
Oh, Norm, anything on this scheduling?
Yeah, just, I mean, the idea of the federal-state conflict is fascinating, and we hear about how because of this issue, we run into problems with banking. It's harder for the states to do testing. But what doesn't get discussed is the potential for opportunities, right? To the extent that you have states that are now, you know, allowing advertising, and so to the extent this is still all illegal under federal law, the federal government could actually use its prosecutorial discretion to shape these markets to say, you know what, you're not selling, you know, if you're selling gummy candies or any products that have THC over 40% or some threshold, you're going to go to the top of our list. You know, there's a lot of things that Cole Memo could have said that it didn't. But the thing to keep in mind is in January of 2017, we're going to have a new president. Mm-hmm. It's unclear whether or not that individual is going to continue down this path of the Obama administration or try something else. So earlier we were talking about how inevitable or whether or not it would be inevitable to have legalization. I do think in the short run, while we have this federal-state conflict, there may be things that we could do to help improve public health.
Okay, I have 4 questioners waiting. That's a fifth. So I'm going to take those, and that probably will take us through to the end of the session. What I'm going to take is the first 3 of those questioners before we ask for responses, so we can get other questions put to the full panel. So we have Alex, yourself, and Angela. And you have you 2 at the back.
This is a question for Beau. If it is the case, which I hope it is, that we all agree that in the principle, that it should not be a criminal offence to possess small amounts of marijuana for your own use, even if we don't like the term decriminalisation. If that's the principle, surely the simplest way of doing that is just to legalise possession. And you talked about there being downsides to this, about the messaging it might send, but given, as we know from Kevin, that most people have no idea what the legal status of a drug is in their country, and they don't understand the difference between legalisation and decriminalisation. Yeah. So can you tell us more about what the mechanism would be by which legalising rather than decriminalising possession would be expected to have a greater impact on use?
No, I was just throwing out.
Question. And that question, I think, needs a bit of thinking about. A couple of more questions. Lady in red in the front.
My name's Jody, and I'm really glad that you started with definitions. In Florida, I tell people that cannabis is legal.
It's legal like dynamite as opposed to legal like spinach. I wanted to ask you about net widening. When I was in Colorado talking to folks in Denver with the Office of Marijuana Policy, they said that prior to the point where we started kind of mucking around, we being marijuana policy advocates like myself, that there were not a whole lot of arrests for cannabis use. But after we started mucking with the laws, that we then, they had laws that had to be enforced. So I was wondering if you had calculated into the net widening the idea that prior to some of these policy changes, officers might have been using a little discretion. They find someone with a little bit of marijuana and they dumped it instead of fining. And lastly, I just wanted to say in terms of cookies and candies, I'm going to remind you all of chocolate milk of magnesia and Mary Poppins, who said a spoonful of sugar made the medicine go down.
We do apologize. Angela, and after this batch of questions, I'll go to the panel.
Just a comment to the question. A comment actually came after your comment, Mike, on this country outside the U.S. That has a different thing. And indeed, I want to think whether the U.S. is actually now is the extreme on this side, but probably has started on the extreme of this side on enforcing prohibition on cannabis in a way that many, many other countries in the world do not do. So I think it's really the two, I mean, typically of the U.S., if I may, you know, having the extremes. If I may, so in general, if I can put the impact of, you call it, I think, Mike, you mentioned it, you know, the definition of depenalization, decriminalization. I mean, depenalization per se is allowed by the convention. And I think I know that probably many of you are not very happy of the outcome of UNGAS document, but actually the mentioning of de facto depenalizing and is not only possession, you know, is minor offenses. So even goes beyond possession can have an impact that is much greater, maybe not in the US where you have that big problem with cannabis, but outside the US, the impact on this, on other drugs, is probably much bigger than what it would be concerning the cannabis. So my question is, how much the debate on whether depenalization or decriminalization of possession goes beyond cannabis in the US?
Okay, so three questions there. I'd ask the panel to comment an observation. Taking into account we have 5 minutes left and two more questioners, so brief comments at this stage.
Very briefly. So, no, you're right. And so that's the whole idea behind net widening is whereas before the cops may have just kind of confiscated the cannabis and thrown it away, now they may be more likely to apply a ticket. And so that's something we really have to pay attention to with respect to youth and kind of what happens here. So it'll be fascinating to kind of see how this plays out in Washington, Colorado, and the other places. And Alex, what I was just trying to think about some possible downsides to this, and I don't have any evidence to back this up. One possibility, though, is to the extent that even within the United States, if you were to look at all of the different laws kind of for possession, and it would be hard for you to pick out what are typically the decriminalization states. So the idea potentially is if one state just decides to legalize possession now and it gets confused with just general legalization, then maybe that could send some signals. I have no idea about whether or not that would actually be the case, but I could see it potentially being different than kind of how we have decriminalization now. As I said, I'm not necessarily advocating for that. I just think it's something to think about here. And to the extent that you could do something like that with a sunset clause, it wouldn't be as much of a risk.
I'm not sure. I think that this whole thing is the health standpoint, which we heard less, the addiction and all of that, and that's the elephant in the room that people don't want to talk about, and the cost for that and all of that. I think it's the problem with the decriminalization. I mean, with the legalization, it has to do with the advertising, but now we have advertising anyway, and I think that if there was a way we could outlaw advertising and promotion, that would be wonderful. We could do a lot of things, but you can see as a doctor, we just see these problems with the opioid. That's part of the opioid problem, Oxycontin and so on, and whatever it is. So we see advertising promotion, and then on the other hand, where the emergency rooms are filled with people and lives falling apart in families. So from our standpoint, we call in the policy people. What can you do? And if you're going to decriminalize it or legalize it, whatever, let's do something to decrease the health risks. And what we heard downstairs, I really appreciate it, the health risks are going to get worse, and the number of people affected and the kinds of people that are going to be affected.
Just very quickly on what Angela said, I think you're right about the extremes from one side or the other. And actually, you know, in this discussion of the opiate and heroin epidemic, there have been, you know, people, governors and others, calling for, you know, bring the death penalty back, bring the, you know. And so this is, I think, a worry of American public policy generally about sort of quick reactions to something and trying to, I think, so so actually that's why maybe I'm in the minority in this room. I find the ACRIM document very helpful because I think it actually helps to chart out what would more of a, for lack of a better term, middle ground look like. That is in UN term speak, not really US speak, but principle of proportionality, where we would want to make sure that we're not going overboard. But also, I think we also would want to understand that this is a much more nuanced issue. So, you know, if somebody, you know, is just in possession of a small amount of any drug, how is that different from somebody who's in possession of a small amount and that is fueling crime and other things? And how does one policy, whether it's treatment only or legalization only or throw them in prison only, apply to such a complex biobehavioral issue as this is the trick.
Okay, thanks. And we have two more questions. I'm determined to get this in. So we have Steve at the back and the gentleman there. Please place your questions as quickly as you can.
Apologies for I missed the beginning of the session, but one of the things that you mentioned, Kevin, was about the you touched on cannabis social clubs in your spectrum. And I think it's quite interesting that you have the cannabis social clubs are a model that nominally, at least, operates within a decriminalization framework, although obviously it's operating in a kind of legal grey area, and it's not officially endorsed by the Spanish government, but it also hasn't been condemned as sitting outside the UN treaties by the INCB. And it's a sort of de facto legal supply club model for small groups of people that seems to, when it operate quite well, in that it's a non-profit system. A lot of the sort of commercial imperatives that people have been worried about that we talked about this morning aren't present. And so what you've got there, I think, is an interesting way in which, within a decriminalization framework, you're seeing a sort of transitional model towards legalization that may be actually quite a positive framework for how we should be thinking about legalization and regulation in terms of non-commercial regulation. I just wondered if anyone was interested in commenting on that as an aspect of the decriminalization discussion.
Okay, panel to the panel in a second, but first you, sir.
Thank you. This question is to Bo. You talked about some of the decriminalization movements creating some tension between the police and the community. I wondered if you could just talk about that a little, because I could see two different trends, perhaps. One is that the police very much opposed the nationwide movement to have concealed carry laws, because they were concerned about violence and the like, but they seem to have come to accept that. I'm wondering if the same sort of result will happen with marijuana legalization. On the other hand, I know there are police officers who use marijuana presence as a basis for making an arrest, not because they want to enforce that law, but because they want to use this person as a source. They now have something over this person, and so they can use this person to find out about what's going on in the neighborhood and the like. And if you decriminalize it or completely legalize it, the police who used to do that now won't be able to do that, and so they'll be unhappy. So things can go in either direction in that regard.
Okay, thanks for those two questions. Observations from the panel on that?
Just quickly before the panelists start, it is now past 1 p.m. You have an hour until the next session begins to get lunch. I just wanted to let all of you know so you wouldn't feel rushed.
Steve, I was talking about this within the context of Washington, D.C., obviously where they're going. In terms of the INCB, I mean, I hope Wayne Hall is not in here. I mean, there's probably three people in Washington, D.C. who know who the INCB is, first of all. But more to the point, I think when you talk about, again, American-style legalization versus Dutch style, it's like some of us are longing for the Dutch style, which we never thought we would say, and that's because it is in such sharp contrast with Americans. So what happens if it goes forward in Washington, D.C., I would be very surprised if it follows the sort of slow and steady, calm and quiet social club model that we've seen in Spain and maybe one or two other countries versus a much more leaning commercial model, even if it is sort of a social club model. So that speaks to needing to, I think, set the context of where you're talking about. And so I think that would lean much more towards sort of the full legal model than the other.
Yeah. Paul, to your last point, this argument that by arresting people for possession, it could provide intelligence that would be useful to the police. I hear this argument. I've seen no empirical evidence for it. I'm not saying that it doesn't happen, but that's why not give it, if you're going to, you know, really try to address this, you know, if you were to legalize possession with the sunset clause, try it for a couple of years. If it turns out that the police really don't like this because they're losing all this information, that then you could take that to help make decisions about what to do next. And so I do think that might be a possibility, but I just haven't seen any evidence for that. And Steve, you know, with respect to the cannabis clubs, they're trying to keep this mostly focused on just possession. But I think you're right, when we're talking about these middle ground options, you know, in the United States, so much of the focus is on either prohibition or the for-profit legal regime. But once you go outside of the United States, people are much more likely to talk about some of these other options that may be more ideal from a public health.
Well, folks, that's all the time we got for today for this recorded edition of the Russ Belville Show from the Cannabis Science and Policy Summit in New York City. We'll bring you more highlights from the summit, and we've got the upcoming United Nations session that we'll bring you highlights for as well. That's it for today. I'm Radical Russ for everyone here at Cannabis Radio. Until next time, take care of each other, tokers.
This is the Russ Belville Show. The Russ Belville Show is blogging and podcasting daily at RadicalRuss.com. Take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it. You take a seed, you plant it, you grow it, you try it, you roll it, you smoke it.